floor is yours.
Thank you, Janne. So can you hear me in the back? You weren't sure about the microphone. Yes, you can. Great. So you stole all of my starting lines. I was going to say the exact same things as you already said, but thank you for the introduction. So I've been working at several different places in Finland and in the US, and commented all of those have been that I've been working with microbial communities and using bioinformatic approaches to analyze those microbial communities. And today, so you can see my title here, so it was what I chose eventually is Illuminating Microbial Communities in the Arctic Using Omics Approaches. And there are several words I'm sure that are might not be familiar for you, but I'm going to explain those to you in the next 20 minutes or so. But just to start, that why is my group working with the Arctic? So Arctic region is warming faster than rest of the globe. So in this figure, let me just check, that is a few years old, you can see that the Arctic region or the high latitudes in here are warming faster than rest of the globe. And especially pronounced the warming is in the wintertime. So you can see that the warming is several degrees faster than in the rest of the globe. So Arctic is warming, and during this year most of the news headlines have been about COVID. So it's been filled with, all the newspapers have been filled with COVID news, but I'm sure that some of you must have seen the news about the Arctic warming and especially the high temperatures measured in Siberia. So at some days it was 45 degrees Celsius. So that causes the permafrost to thaw in Siberia and throughout the Arctic. And that is causing dramatic changes to the world. And as the permafrost starts to thaw in these regions, we are not really sure what's going to happen. So permafrost is soil that is at or below the freezing point of water for two or more years in a row. And you can see the permafrost region in this map with the purple colors. And this region stores twice as much carbon as there is currently in the atmosphere. And that is, and also around 50% of Earth's below ground carbon is stored in this northern region. So it's a huge amount of carbon is stored here. And as climate is warming, that carbon starts to be decomposed. So microbes are really the ones that control what is happening to the carbon in permafrost soils. And microbes are also being affected by the rising temperatures. So as microbes respond to the temperature, we don't know what is going to happen to the carbon that is stored in there. At the moment, there is a balance that carbon is going into the permafrost soils and it's also being released. But as permafrost starts thawing, the microbial decomposition microbes get active and more of the carbon is going to be decomposed. And then there's a chance that in the future more of this carbon is going to be released to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and methane, which are greenhouse gases. But as I said, we don't really know how microbes control this carbon in there, how much they get active, and that is something that my group has been working on since 2017. So how you normally, or how one of the approaches that you could analyze microbial communities is by culturing. But microbes are extremely difficult to culture. And so that's why it's not the method that we are using in my group. And I'm not a big fan of culturing either. Because if you have the same microbe, here's a cartoon where a microbe is living in the soil and it's not feeling that well. But once the same microbe is living in the pure culture with this nutrient-rich, high nutrient media, it's feeling great. And of course, then the phenotype is totally different for these microbes. The common way to analyze microbial communities is via 16S rRNA amplicon sequencing. This is one gene that is ubiquitous in all microbes, but then you only get the taxonomy of the microbes and not really the function, what they're doing. And what interests me personally more is what the microbes can do than what they are. So the methods we are using in my group are called multi-omics methods. And so we are using metagenomics, metatranscriptomics, and metaproteomics. So first about metagenomics, there you sequence. Okay, so there you sequence all of the DNA in a sample. So you just take the sample, extract DNA, and sequence everything. And then you get all the species in a sample sequenced. So you know what kind of species you have in the sample. And then you also get all the genes in the sample, so you know what kind of processes the microbial community or the community overall can do in your samples. And if you then assemble those short reads you get from sequencing, you get longer contigs, and those contigs can be then binned in the metagenome assembled genomes, which are called MAGs. And in the next slide, I will tell you a bit more about what the MAGs are. Then the second approach we are using is metatranscriptomics, where you sequence all of the RNA extracted from your sample. So with this approach, you get to know which of those species in your sample are really active at the time of sampling, and also what those genes, which genes are doing what in your sample at the time of sampling. So you get really precise information on what the community is doing. And then with metaproteomics, you sequence all of the proteins, and this is an approach that we don't use that much in my group because it's more expensive, and then you need a huge amount of sample for the protein analysis. But with this, you get information about which proteins are being translated and what are really the active metabolic processes in your sample, and also from which species those proteins are originating from. So for MAGs, to tell more about the MAGs, so the metagenome assembled genomes, I have a few slides from my colleague, Murat Eren, from University of Chicago, because I think he has really nice cartoons explaining what the MAGs are, and they are really important for this presentation. So it starts by you having your sample, and in this case, your sample has four different species. You extract the DNA, do shotgun sequencing, and get short reads from them. After that, the short reads are de novo assembled into longer sequence reads called contigs. And then with an approach called metagenomic binning, they are binned in the MAGs, so the metagenome assembled genomes. These are not complete genomes, but usually we get from 50 to 95% complete genomes with this approach. And so basically you start with this community and you get the same community or genomic information of the chain community without culturing. The problem with metagenomic binning is that it's really time-consuming. So my postdoc spent around 11 months just analyzing our data set and binning the genomes, but now we have really nice data set to start writing papers about. So why we need more genomes? So why am I using this time-consuming approach of getting the metagenomic sequences? It's because we don't know so much about the microbial world at the moment. So here's a rather decent, recent version of the phylogenetic tree of life, and we humans are somewhere around here, so here are eukaryotes. So there's archaea and all the bacteria in here. And the taxa that we have cultures trained for are the ones that do not have the red dot. So there's a lot of proteobacteria, cyanobacteria, and actinobacteria that we have been able to sequence or culture and sequence. And those are usually the human pathogens or the otherwise species that are interesting for human health. But most of the environmental microbes, so the ones in candidate phyla radiation or in other phylum in here, do not have sequence representative for or culture representative for them. And the genome sequences are from MAGs, or they are sometimes called TRAF genomes or community genomes. So by this approach, we get new members to the tree of life. We get better explanation that what these microbes actually do. And then also we get good database that we need for this omics method. Because currently, most of the sequence databases are not complete, that we don't have all the information there that we need. So my group has been working mainly with two regions in the Arctic. So one is here in Alaska, and one is in Finnish Lapland in Kilpisjärvi. And in Kilpisjärvi, we are working on this large landscape window between Mount Sana and Mount Jehkas. And we have 118 sample points there that somehow reflect the status that what the climate change is going to do to the Arctic. So we have there less productive regions and more productive regions and warmer regions. Then we have south-facing slope and north-facing slope, which get really different amount of snow in the winter and different radiation that, of course, reflects the status of the samples. And there's acidic region and samples that are occasionally neutral. And then there's also a lot of difference in the local topography, soil moisture, and plant species distribution. So we've been sampling this region now 3 years in a row in the summer, and we were going to go there this year as well in the winter and in the summer, but unfortunately, all of our sampling trips were cancelled. But we have now data from 3 years, so we've been taking samples from organic soil layer and mineral layer, and then we extract DNA, RNA, and proteins, sequence them, and then also measure different environmental data. And we are also utilizing data from Miskell Waters Group at Department of Geography, so they have really in detail measurements throughout the year on those same sample sites. And then we are gonna, but then we finally do the data analysis, so the bioinformatics and statistics. If we think how much this takes time in a year, so sampling takes around 1 month, and the wet lab part around 2 months, and then the data analysis part takes rest of the year, so around 9 months of the year. My group is working on computer analyzing the data sets. So here's some rather recent results from my group. So this is work done by Igor Bessy, my postdoc, and this is something that we are going to submit really soon. So there's a lot of information in this figure, but I'm going to walk you through it. So here are what was the base of this work. It was 1.5 terabases of sequence data from these 118 samples. Actually, well, here's only 46 samples, sorry. And we had also 4 nanopore flow cells for long reads. So we had those longer sequence reads for scaffolding purposes, so we get better as metagenomic assembly. And what we have in the end is over 540 non-redundant bacterial and archaea genomes. So the genomes are in the phylogenetic tree on the base of the tree here. And each of these row is one sample. And we have here, the blue ones are wetland samples. The purple are our barren sample. And then, these are the heatland samples, and the orange ones are the wetland samples. So we had sort of two different vegetation or sample types here. And so when you see a color in here, it means that this MAC was present in this sample. So what you can just fast see here is that there are some taxa that are in the wetland only, some that are in the heatland only, and some that we can find in both of these sample types. I could easily spend 20 minutes talking only about this figure, so I will just show you some highlights of the results. So most of our MAGs were actually acidobacterial. So there was over 120 of acidobacterial MAGs. And acidobacteria are really common soil microbes. Then we also had archaea, so those were, and you can see that those were mainly present in the wetlands. So those are the methanogenic archaea producing methane and sort of the bad type of bacteria or microbe in the Arctic. And then we also had a lot of Eremiobacterota, Varroacomicrobia, and Dormibacterota. And okay, I forgot the mark here, so the turquoise one is my favorite, Chloroflexi. And those are microbes that we don't know that much about. So they are soil microbes or environmental microbes that have rarely been seen in studies, and we don't have much of genomes for those. So I'm really excited that we can publish these results because we're going to have more information on these less known taxa. Especially interested or excited I am for the Eremiobacterota. So at the moment, there's only a handful of genomes in GeneBank, and they are not of that good quality. And we have been now able to get 5 different Eremiobacterota that are from a bit different types. So in the phylogenetic tree, they cluster to different places. And what is really interesting is that one of these seems to be nitrogen fixing. So we see a lot of nitrogen fixation in this site. And also the nitrogen fixation is in several different taxonomic phylum. So there's a lot of diversity in this, and this is something that we really need to combine now, the metatranscriptomic data, to understand that are these really functional, and when is the nitrogen fixation the metabolic method the bacteria or archaea chooses. So we have, like I said, we had around 120 acidobacteria, so we can now really deepen our understanding on the acidobacterial taxonomy and the functions they do. So if you're not familiar with acidobacteria, they are clustered to these groups, GP1, GP2, 3, 4, and so on. And we have a lot of, so the ones marked in bold are our MAGs. And we have a lot of MAGs from the cluster GP1, some from GP2 and the other ones. But then there are also MAGs from 3 clusters marked here in blue, green, and this yellowish. that we did not have representative strain sequence before. So this is something that we definitely need to work a bit more on to understand what these are, and hopefully to get the 16S rRNA to the metagenomic bins so we can really assign the taxonomy for them. So until now I've been talking only about our metagenomes, but like I said, we also extract RNA and do metatranscriptomes. So Sirja Viitamäki, who is a PhD student in my group, has been analyzing these metatranscriptomic datasets and how she clustered these samples, or found that the cluster actually sample are based on vegetation. At first we thought that pH or soil moisture is the main driver for the community clustering, but with the sort of third or second stage of our analysis, we found that it's actually the vegetation is a big driver. So the graminoid soils are really distinct from the other types. And also the barren soil is somewhat different, but then the shrubs are really clustering tightly together. So the microbial activity is driven by the vegetation of the sample. We used linear model to analyze these differences and saw that especially the graminoid soil, which is marked in purple in here, was different in several of these. So certain genera, which are so this is on genus level, were more active in the graminoid soil than in the other soil types. And also we saw that then the two shrubs were rather similar, and that then the remaining barren soil was usually a bit different than the shrubs. This is some ongoing work still, so we need to figure out that what is actually causing the activity of these bacterial and archaeal genus in these samples. So what I would like to do here in Jyväskylä, in my lab, so of course I would like to continue this omics approach on the Arctic region and on other soil types as well. So we have now just two regions that we are working on, so Kilpisjärvi and Alaska. And so I've been already discussing with my collaborators that we could get samples from Greenland, from Cambridge Bay in High Arctic in Canada, and on other sort of permafrost thaw gradient in Alaska. And then also there's discussions of getting samples from Siberia. So most of the Arctic work has really focused on Alaska and on Scandinavia, so that's why I think it would be great to have this sort of circumpolar gradient of samples and then to get information that are there some cosmopolitan taxa that are present in everywhere, some genes or metabolic pathways that are present everywhere, and then also get seasonal information. So until now, our sampling has been done only in the summer because it's much easier to go to the Arctic regions in the summer than in the winter when there's up to 3 meters of snow and a lot of darkness. But I think it's really important to know also what happens in the winter and in the spring and fall. And then I would like to complement this data with really detailed flux information. So at the moment we have flux data for these samples, but it's not that in-depth analyzed. And I think here I could have good opportunities to incorporate the flux data or measure the flux data and incorporate that to our samples. Although I said in the beginning that I'm not a big fan of culturing, I still would like to culture some bacteria or get the single individual cells, because when we are doing our MAGs, there's always possibility that we are doing chimeric MAGs, that our MAGs are not only from the taxa we think they are, but there is some of the contigs are from wrong or other species or strain that is closely related to the taxa we are working on. So that's why I would like to do some single cell sorting with using fish, so we could fish out those cells of interest that are from the taxa we want to work more on, for example, the Eremiobacterota. Or then to use stable isotope probing with 13C or 15N incubations, and then extract the cells from the incubations, and then use Raman imaging for the cell sorting with the SIP to get those cells of interest that are doing the function we are interested of. For example, methane oxidation or methane production or different parts of this nitrogen cycle. Our samples I've been talking now about bacteria and archaea. So those are the main partners in our samples, but there's also fungi. So here's the fungal, all of the rRNA reads in our sample, and around 11% of the rRNA reads are fungal. So that is something that I would really like to focus more on. And then as the Arctic changes, the vegetation changes as well. So I think here I could have good collaboration in combining the vegetation changes to the below ground carbon communities, and by utilizing these omics approaches I've been talking about. And then there's a lot of speculation by me and others that is the large fraction of unknown genes in metagenomes. What are those? Are they genes that we just don't know, or could they be viral genes? Because there is viral component in the microbial community, so that is something that I would like to work a bit more as well. For teaching, I would like to train microbiologists and molecular biologists in microbial bioinformatics and omics analysis. So I don't see myself as training bioinformaticians as such, but more on training the microbiologists in having the skills to utilize those large omics sets or large sequence data sets to understand the phenomena in microbial communities and microbial genomics. And then also I wrote here yesterday that not to fear the command line and programming, that to have those skills by molecular biologists who have experience in bioinformatics as well. So I see myself really teaching at the Department of Biological and Environmental Sciences, microbial bioinformatics, molecular biology, and microbiology. And then I've been teaching these intensive lab courses on omics for 4 years in a row now. So I would really like to continue it here and then also supervise student thesis. Then with Nanoscience Center, I think we could have a new lecture series on omics and then also laboratory courses on this and then supervise students. And then for Department of Mathematics and Statistics, my data sets are large and they require a lot of statistic knowledge. So I'm sure that there could be some joint supervision with those them as well. So thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
So how your work is going to answer to that? So what are the historical samples you are comparing? Because you are basically measuring situation what is now happening. So how it is helping us to understand what is happening?
So I'm preparing the question in case there are people watching the live stream. So the question was that, because I'm working with climate change, so what are the historical samples I'm comparing my current state samples for? And that's a really good question, and I should have explained more in detail. So with the climate gradient, we have those sort of historical cells that are not thawing at the moment. So then we are comparing them to the ones that are warming much faster than the other ones in the gradient. And then in Alaska, we have a climate permafrost thaw gradient where we have the intact permafrost and then the different stage when permafrost is actually collapsing to thermokarst bog. So I don't have the historical samples, but it's more that I have the samples that are still in the permafrost and then the ones that are already thermokarst bog and really collapsed and warm and methanogenic as well.
Yeah. Maybe follow up. So what's the time frame now that you can follow up as you can check the change? It's only a few years now.
Yeah. So the question is, what is my time frame? Because I've been only working for this with these samples for 4 years, and the time frame, of course, that we don't have the DNA and RNA except now. But then those frozen samples, they are over 10,000 years old, so they are Pleistocene permafrost. So they are, at the moment, still really old. But as the warming is so fast, that how well we can actually catch the samples before they warm too much. So the question was about the metaproteomes, that what kind of approach we use and how can we analyze the data or combine the data with the functions. So we are using mass spectrometry, so we are using Orbitrap for that purpose. And what I learned during my postdoc in the US is that the key with environmental metagenomes is that metaproteomes, that you run them for a really long time because there's a lot of echo in there and a lot of background noise that you need to really, that you get the peaks for the proteins, you need to run them for at least 24 hours. So it's really time-consuming and expensive at the same time. And for as a database, we've been using our matching metagenome. So if we use the gene bank data, we don't find that much of or most of our proteins are not assigned as function. But when we use the annotated matching metagenome, we can really get much better information on the proteins that are present in our sample. So the key is in creating your own database for your sample.
For me, it always struck me that these sort of 1 meter boxes didn't represent the diversity of the soil there. You've got this amazingly detailed sampling. Do you think that taking a small core is representative of the microbial community? Or do you need 5 cores or 10 cores? What sort of spatial scale do you need to characterize microbial diversity at a site?
Yeah. So there was 2 questions. So I will first answer the nanopore technology. So how the long read technology has helped our metagenome assembly. And it helped, but not as much as I hoped. So our nanopore reads were around 5,000 base pair long, or 5 kb long. And they really helped scaffolding some of the mags. And we got some 16S. So usually in metagenome assembled genomes, you don't have 16S for them, because 16S is that conserved gene that the mag, meaning you don't really know that which genome it belongs to. But we got now some 16S, so that was a good thing for us. But still, the proportion of the nanopore reads that assembled with our short reads was rather low, so it was around 50%. So I was hoping that we could have used all of the nanopore reads. But it helped. But there's only we only did just 4 runs this spring, so it was sort of a corona present for myself to buy the nanopore and then utilize the conference money that I didn't use for something useful. And then the second question was about the spatial sampling, that is one individual core representative of the soil. And of course it's not. I mean, so much is going on in soil that that's something that I've been struggling a lot, that how are we going to do our sampling? But I decided eventually that we will have the gradient of the 118 samples and have just individual cores and not start pooling cores at the site. Because when we're working with RNA, you need to be really fast. So we've been carrying this huge liquid nitrogen tank with us so we can snap freeze our samples. So we chose that it's just one. But of course, if we would take samples 10 centimeters apart, they would be totally different from that one site. But we are now measuring, taking our just one sample core right next to the, so there are those TOMs that measure the different temperature and moisture there in our sites, so right next to those. But that's a struggle, of course, that what is the spatial variation and how you're going to plan your samples.
I struggle to believe some of these small experimental setups.
Yeah. Of course, those grids, that what is that it can be that there's this different plant there, or there has been a dead bunny last year that is causing some differences. So with soil, it's always tricky.
We have time for one question. Lottis, do you have?
Yeah. So I was just wondering that you mentioned viruses there. That is your sampling protocol selective for certain particle size or cell size of organisms?
Yeah, so I just got a postdoc trying. So she will join in 1 month, my group. So she's going to work with viruses. And we've been discussing this a lot with her and with our collaborators abroad. And so we are extracting the total RNA, and we don't have any filters there. So we should get all the fragments. But, of course, some of those viral fragments are really small, so we might lose them. But we are now trying first with just the sort of traditional metagenomic library preparation. But that's something that we might need to do different extractions for the viruses. But there's a lot of soil stored in the freezer, so you can start playing around with that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Inge.
Thank you.